Post-bac programs for physician wannabes can make all the difference between rejection and acceptance for academic enhancers and career changers. Let's learn about the two post-bac programs offered by Johns Hopkins University from their director, Dr. Alexandra Tan. Welcome to the 264th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm accepted!" Not only accepted, but accepted at the best program for you. This podcast is brought to you by Accepted's free guide, The A to Z of Applying to Post-Bac Programs, which teaches you how to write an effective personal statement and obtain essential letters of recommendation. It also covers who should apply to post-bac programs, as well as the different types of post-bac programs. Download your copy at accepted.com/pb or from the link in our show notes at accepted.com/264. Our guest today is Dr. Alexandra Tan, who earned her BS at the University of Central Arkansas and then went on to get her PhD in molecular biology and biophysics at Johns Hopkins in 2009. And somewhere along the way, she got bitten by the pre-med post-bac educational bug. She became director of Johns Hopkins Post-Baccalaureate Pre-Medical Program for Career Changers in 2012 and founded and became director of the Johns Hopkins Post-Baccalaureate Health Science Intensive Program, also in 2012. Her approach to post-bac education is highly analytical and data-driven. She has been working to identify objective predictors of success in the medical school admissions process and develop tangible steps that help students achieve that success. Dr. Tan, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to speak with you today. Let's start with the basics. What is the post-baccalaureate pre-medical program at Johns Hopkins, and who is it for? And then we'll get to the HSI, the Health Science Intensive, in just a second. So start with the first one, okay?
Sure. So post-bac programs in general, for anybody who's unfamiliar, they're essentially programs that are designed to give students sort of an extension of their undergraduate time to accomplish a particular set of goals. There are two types of post-bac programs. They are classically called usually career changer programs or academic enhancer programs. And the pre-medical program is a career changer program, which means it's essentially designed for students who need that extra time to be able to complete the lower division science classes. So these are students who haven't had the year of biology, general chemistry, organic chemistry, and physics. More specifically, Hopkins in general is true to its reputation for being very strong in research, and we certainly care a lot about leadership and independence and support for our unique individual students. And so this program also encompasses a lot of those other qualities as well.
Okay, so the post-bac pre-medical program is for career changers. What about the health sciences intensive? How is it different, both in its structure and, I guess, its outcome?
Sure.
The outcome is supposed to be the same, but...
Sure. Yes, that's true. In both cases, the students have the same goals. That's very true. So as I said, there are two kinds of programs. The Health Science Intensive Program is categorically considered an academic enhancer program, which essentially means that you've had the biology, the general chemistry, the organic chemistry, and the physics courses, the associated labs, and all of that completed. So post-bac programs vary a lot if you just look at what they accept and nationally what they look like. But generally speaking, students who are eligible for one program would be ineligible for the other one and vice versa. So So the academic enhancer programs nationally are going to have some version of upper division courses, of advanced science courses, and opportunities for students to demonstrate their academic prowess in a science classroom. But on upper division or graduate level classes, the HSI program in particular is a graduate level program. So the students are exclusively taking graduate level courses. But you're right, a lot of the outcomes and goals are largely the same. One pretty significant difference between the two programs, though, is that career changer programs nationally well, it could be a two-year program or it could be a one-year program. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of classes to complete. The way that would be closest to an undergrad completing the classes would be a two-year program. And so that's the level of the pace of studying and comfort that most students are familiar with having gone through the U.S. education system. When you compress that into a one-year, as we do with the post-bac pre-med program, our career changer program, it doesn't leave a lot of time for a lot of other things, but in return, you get to move through the process more quickly. The HSI program, the Academic Enhancer program, is closer. It's still a one-year program, but it's closer to the typical pace of an academic setting, which means that it also allows students a lot more time for personal exploration, building on the application they have as far as experiences are concerned, exploring topics of social justice, advocacy, research, community health, innovation, any topics that are of interest to them. And so there's a little more time in the HSI program to focus on those things.
Is it a two-year program?
It's a one-year program still. It's just because of the number of classes. Because of the amount of coursework, it's just a little more relaxed.
And I believe with HSI, you also get a degree, right? Whereas with...
You do. Right. Yeah, you get a Master's of Science degree in biotechnology. Typically, career changer programs are certificate programs because they're undergraduate level.
Right. The HSI is more for academic enhancers, right? So people who
yes.
might have had the science courses but didn't mm-hmm. do so well in them.
Well, actually, that's not necessarily true. So
okay.
academic enhancer programs, classically, thus the name,
right.
were originally designed for people who went through their undergraduate career and didn't do as well as they should have. That's definitely true.
Okay.
Should have. The definition of that has changed as schools have gotten more competitive. And so, you know, we have students who I'm sure their mothers and fathers are very proud of them, but they're not competitive for medical school. So there's definitely that piece. And there are lots of reasons why that could be the case. We have a growing number of students who are working their way through school. And so they have a lot on their plate. It's not that they're not academically capable. It's just that they're exceedingly busy. And then we also actually have students who academically are strong enough that theoretically they could probably get into medical school, but maybe not the schools they want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have a student who could get into a medical school, but they want to do MD PhD programs or some other combined degree program, maybe that's more competitive, or maybe they just want to be more assured that they're going to get into their top tier schools. And so we see more and more students pursuing academic enhancer programs for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition, as economic things have changed in the world and there's been more pressure on universities, we're seeing the changing landscape of advising and the ability of students to get lots of hands-on, direct, very well-informed help to also be impacting students. And sometimes students just feel like they don't know what they're doing in the admissions process. They don't understand what the expectations are. They feel totally lost in the process. Their advisors, and I'm not dumping on advisors, I feel mm-hmm. for them. They feel very overwhelmed and unable to give each and every student under their care the level of dedication that students are hoping to receive. And so sometimes those students also will pursue an academic enhancer program because typically, certainly in the case of Hopkins, but typically post-bac programs tend to have a stronger, more hands-on, more direct advising component that helps those students figure out exactly what they need to do to be successful in that process.
What is different about HSI as opposed to other academic enhancer programs?
Well, so a couple of things. So originally when I designed it, we were thinking about going back to the literature, really thinking about what medical schools want in pre-med students and really trying to address that much more directly rather than it being a byproduct that students happen to go to medical school. And mm-hmm. I saw in the literature that there was definitely this emphasis on the sciences and the things that we expect everyone understands to be an expectation of pre-med students applying to medical school. But then there is also this other broad swath of characteristics that are part of that medical school expectation. They include leadership, they include professionalism, communication skills, some, you know, cultural competency, a dedication to service, all these other components that they want to see in students. And as an educator and somebody who spent a lot of time in an educational setting, it occurred to me that, you know, we, especially for the sciences, we expect students to be good communicators because they are surrounded with people that they must communicate with. We expect them to be culturally competent because they are surrounded by people who come from different cultures. But we don't necessarily do that with the sciences. If I said, okay, we're going to teach chemistry by just putting somebody in the presence of a periodic chart, people would think that was crazy. So I felt like those additional components, maybe there was a way to be more deliberate, to not hope that students get that stuff, but to deliberately, in a classroom setting, introduce them to those topics, get them thinking, and more importantly, discussing those topics, so that hopefully when we send them off to medical school, they feel more competent, they feel more capable, they feel more confident with those skill sets. And so the HSI program, in addition to including a heavy dose of the science courses that everyone would expect and you see in academic enhancer programs, there is also non-science courses that are included in the curriculum. And that currently includes a leadership course, a communications course, and then we have a psychosocial determinants of health and implications on diagnostics course. So that's more cultural competency. I say currently because right now we're looking in a new direction. The other thing that we are starting to see with our students truly organically is that we have an unusually high number of really innovative and students who are really eager to develop things towards social justice and change in the world. Student organizations, lecture series, some of them want to create nonprofits, blogs for outreach, all sorts of things. And they're doing this totally organically. It's not really part of our curriculum, but innovation and creativity is one of my favorite things, one thing that I find very professionally satisfying. And so right now we're working on, you know, are there ways that we can build into the curriculum more encouragement for students and more support for students who are innovatively inclined even to a small degree. And the reason that we're doing that is that certainly all of the sciences and, you know, all those things that are going to remain in the program are extremely important. I don't want to, you know, de-emphasize that.
Right, no, they're foundational.
Yes, absolutely. And we do spend an immense amount of time on that. Mm-hmm. But I also think that in order to apply those sciences, you have to think about, you know, okay, I'm going to create a drug for this particular disease that my patients are suffering with, and here's how I'm going to tackle that. And the science foundation and all of that is really, really important for, you know, these future physicians to be able to do that. But the ability to be able to look at something and say, that is a problem and it's a problem that I can solve, is a very important quality for really anybody professionally, but certainly future physicians. They're tackling an incredibly changing world. And we have to arm them to be able to not just look at those things and say, it would be great if that would change, but I don't know how to do that. So the goal is to evolve as the needs of our students are evolving. And it looks like we have a lot of students who want to change stuff. And so we're looking to further support them.
You're encouraging them really to take initiative.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Take initiative and innovate. What is the application process for these two programs?
It's a pretty typical application. If you go to the websites, I know we'll be talking about that later. It's a pretty classic online application that in many ways mimics the American Medical School Association application, the classic MCAS application. It has all the components that you would expect. There's a personal statement essay. There's, you know, a request for resume or experiences. Your medically relevant experiences, references, all those sorts of things. There is one slight difference for the HSI application. We have two kind of oddity additions. One is there is a second essay. It's called Different This Time. And we included that because we found in the early iterations students wanted to write their personal statement about how this time it was going to be different. And that's not what we want in a personal statement. So we wanted to give students an opportunity to set out a plan about what their goals were for the year and how this year was going to be different, how they were going to, you know, grow and learn and improve, and separate that from their essentially kind of why medicine classic personal statement. And then the second thing we added, I think this coming year we're going to make it optional because I don't want it to be an obstacle for students, but is we've been playing with a video component to the application. So often when you sit on admissions committees, you get these, you know, paper applications and it makes the students feel very two-dimensional, which is misleading. And so we included the video component. It's very open-ended for students, just a short video, just so we have a human being that goes with the application, which helps us to think more humanistically and holistically about the person and the application that we're reviewing.
So you're planning to make that component optional or to introduce it as an optional component?
Right. So we've had it as a required part of the application, and we have found it to be exceedingly helpful. But we have gone back and forth about whether there are students who are not applying because they're intimidated by that and how to tackle that. And we're in discussion about it. So one possibility would be to eliminate it as a requirement. And then if students were intimidated by that, they didn't have to do it. But then just to try to make a compelling case for why it would be a good idea for students to do so that they feel encouraged, but not required.
It's an increasingly common component in business school admissions.
It is, yes.
And job helpful. Interviews. And job interviews.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're great. Students do amazing videos. I haven't seen one yet that I didn't just love. I mean, they do great stuff. It's wonderful to watch. But I wouldn't want anybody to be overly self-conscious about it.
Right. As I said in the intro, you've done a lot of research on what are the predictors of success in medical school. And I know you approach that in a very analytical kind of PhD research-driven way. What are the predictors? What has your research shown?
Well, I mean, so I'm still working on it. It's a work in progress, and and we're still trying to pull it apart and think more carefully about it. But the thing that I have found is that honestly, this is something that if you read more into the published literature, it seems somewhat obvious, although students don't think it's obvious. I think when you look at the data, you will see that, you know, the metrics, the GPA and the MCAT score and all of those pieces that give medical schools a certain sense of comfort that they're not dooming you to failure when they accept you to medical school is an important part of the review that medical schools are doing. That's not in dispute. It's important. But I think also that students overemphasize that component. And, you know, schools in this country, universities in this country, because we also emphasize classes and academic excellence, I don't necessarily think that we dissuade students from that perspective as much as perhaps we should. But there is a huge other component to the application that is important. And those are the things that you learn from being a citizen of the world. You learn from being in a professional setting. You learn from having disagreements and interactions with other people, from having personal failures, and, you know, from just knowing yourself and understanding your path in the world and what that looks like for you. And I think that students really don't spend enough time thinking about that component. And I think that has a lot to do with students not being successful in the application process. So, for example,
I was going to ask you for one.
Yes. So one example would be if you talk to students about how they select the medical schools that they're applying to, they seem very confused by that question. And generally what they will tell you is some version of, well, I'm applying to good schools, or I looked at the US News Reports list and I, you know, picked these schools. And there is no component of it that has anything to do with their fit with the particular schools. And the school, in contrast to that, that is all they think about. They are thinking about the fit of the student with the school. And so, for example, what I tell my students in terms of an analogy so that hopefully that makes more sense is that if you're going on a date.
Right. I was just thinking someone. That's where you were going.
Yeah. Yes. If you're going on a date with someone and the date doesn't work out, right? You don't end the date thinking, I am a horrible person. I am undateable. I should just give up on dating because it's over. My life is over. I might as well just go live in a box, right? Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, people don't make that assumption. If they go on a date and it doesn't work out, then they think, oh gosh, I didn't have a lot in common with that person. They liked this. I liked that. I didn't realize that they were... Yeah, there, you know, I need to be more specific about how I select people or where I go to find people or whatever your criteria is, right? Like the fact that I don't mesh with somebody who enjoys a lot of sports doesn't make me a horrible person. It just makes me someone who shouldn't date someone who's very into sports. And I think that students don't think of admissions that way. They take every rejection very seriously, but then they also don't do that characteristic selection where, you know, medical schools are definitely thinking about, is this person the kind of person that we want to be a physician? Are they interested in medicine because it is a service profession? Do they understand the field and know what they're getting into? You know, generally speaking, that's the generalized, are you a good date, period, right? Mm-hmm. But much more of the selection criteria, particularly during the interview process, but in the secondaries as well, and certainly to some degree in the primary application, is about all of the nuanced difference between this school and that school. And one thing that I have found very interesting about sitting in on like medical school admissions meetings is that there is a lot of conversation about this kid is going to be a great physician someday, but not at our medical school. Hmm. Like it's not an issue of dispute that they are a good candidate for medicine. The dispute is this place the best place for them? Which I found very eye-opening, you know, that a lot of it is much more about, yes, but at this institution or other places. And one way that we've really been able to help students be more successful in the application process is just to force more conversation or encourage more conversation about the specificity of fit, really understanding what they want in a medical school, what medical schools want in a student, and really getting to know themselves to a level where they can really have those deeper conversations about that. And I think that that makes a significant difference. The other thing that I think makes a significant difference is that there are some things that are just tried and true good advice, like applying early and, you know, having letters of recommendation from people who actually know you, that you will hear from any advisor that are obvious good suggestions that, frankly, I don't need data to support. But I have. I've talked to deans of medical schools about this as well, and it really is a lot of specificity. And so in terms of the data, you know, that level of yes, this, but not that is hard if it's really based on individuality. And so I think to me, that's the challenge of medical school admissions is trying to fit those nuanced pieces together.
We also emphasize in advising our clients the importance of fit with specific medical schools, especially in terms of the secondaries and the interview component of medical school applications. But some of the qualities that you were talking about sound like self-awareness, maturity, mm-hmm. and resilience.
Absolutely. No question. I can't tell you what's important to you. You have to tell me. And if you don't know, then you have to figure it out. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I really appreciate with working with this particular population versus younger populations, I taught high school years ago, and one thing I'm really grateful to not have to do anymore is that I can really hold my students accountable for being adults and being mature and really doing that level of self-exploration. I also think it's really important for being happy professionally.
Yes.
You know, that you need to know what you need to be happy and successful. You need to define success, not look it up in a dictionary. And I think that that's really important because otherwise, how will you know when you get there?
Right. Yeah. You got to know where you're going.
Yes.
How do the Johns Hopkins post-bac programs either nurture or foster those qualities in the programs that you run?
So one thing is that we have a year-long advising course that our students participate in. We have a curriculum for it. We have a number of assignments, and it's a very comfortable format for people who are, you know, eager to be in an academic environment. Mm-hmm. And we lay out all of our objectives and all of our goals for students so that they understand where we're going and what we're trying to accomplish. And I think that helps students build a sense of trust that we're going to be able to help them achieve their goals if they just stick with us. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important, because I think that we all have a tremendous ability to grow as people and do that level of self-exploration and self-knowledge and all of that. But I think we have a lot of fear about doing it or uncertainty. And certainly I have had students say, yeah, but how is this going to help me get into medical school? And so we try to build an infrastructure that helps students understand that we are heading towards the goals that they want and that they need to stick with us and we will get them there. And so through the process of starting with very easily accessible questions, we just talk about things like, talk about somebody who was impactful in your life. Talk about a situation that you were really happy, a favorite book, a superpower you wish you had. We sort of, from a backdoor almost, start accessing a student perspective. And we basically act as, what's a good word, an interpreter of a student's internal dialogue. So a lot of times students are very good at telling me who they are, but they're not good at listening to themselves telling them who they are.
They may also be not very good at controlling what they tell themselves about who they are.
Yeah, and I think that if we ask them, like if I ask a student, who are you? I'm frankly probably not going to get a very good answer. I'm going to get some manufactured, this is what I tell people. And particularly for the career changers who have a personal identity that in many ways is wrapped up in another field, that can be an exceedingly hard direction for them because they aren't quite at a point where they see themselves as future physicians. I mean, they want to be physicians, but they aren't like, I've tried to be a physician my whole life. They're not quite there yet. So, you know, you kind of have to ask them what seem like silly questions just to head them down that road and get them thinking about, you know, what's important to them and what would they like to accomplish and, you know, where do they see themselves down the road without actually asking them, where do you see yourself in 20 years, which is an incredibly scary question, even for me. And so to ask a student that question and expect an authentic, real answer, I think is asking too much.
What do you see as the big advantage to students who invest in a formal post-bac program, like the ones that you are the director of, as opposed to doing informal post-bac programs, taking classes?
Okay, so if you're talking about informal post-bac programs just as students who are taking classes, mm-hmm. I think honestly the academic component of what's expected for a post-bac student is, it's pretty easy to figure out. You can look at the prereq lists from medical schools, you can piece that together, you can, if your academic grades are not where they should be, maybe you're just retaking classes that you didn't do well in or whatever. It's pretty straightforward. And I don't think most of the time that is the piece that's difficult for students. I think the most frustrating, confusing part of the process is everything else, even very practical things like what should be included in a personal statement? How do I think about a list of target medical schools to apply to? I need to talk to somebody about my MCAT score. What do I do now? I'm struggling with the CARS section. What do I do now? Should
What's
I use
early? What is
What's
applying
early?
Early?
Yes. What's the difference between using Dr. Smith for using Dr. Smith versus Dr. Peterson, you know, for a letter? Should I do this? Should I do that? What's included in the secondary? Can you look at my experiences? How do I handle the most meaningful prompts? Those things are the parts that hang students up and force them into a position where they're trying to make the best decision they can, but they simply don't have enough information. And so I think the benefit of a post-bac program is that, as I said earlier, often, though not universally, post-bac programs are going to have access to hands-on academic advising. That's certainly not true of all post-bac programs, but it tends to be a larger component of post-bac programs. Mm-hmm. And so really what you're getting out of those programs is, yes, absolutely the ability to take classes and somebody to talk to about your classes, sure. But it's also everything else. Which experiences should I pursue? Should I do research or should I not do research? Do I need to do community health? Having somebody to ask those questions and being able to trust the information you're getting, I think, is totally invaluable.
Yeah, big difference.
And so, yeah, it absolutely does. And so, I mean, I think definitely that's an advantage to post-bac programs. I do know, in talking to just general students, not necessarily just mine, but at conferences and things, that sometimes students do have access to their undergraduate pre-professional advising office after they graduate, like as an alum. Mm-hmm. Not true at every university, but some students do. And so if you have access to that through an undergraduate office and you feel like you're getting adequate support, yes, you can absolutely do it through just taking classes somewhere, because you are getting that information some other place. And so doing it through a post-bac program wouldn't be necessary. But there are lots of students that either feel like either they don't get access to the pre-prof office for some amount of time after they leave, or maybe, yes, they do theoretically, but them and hundreds upon hundreds of other students, or they in some way feel like it's inadequate if they're at a university where their advisors are generalists, or it's a small institution where it's not somebody. So I, for example, do nothing but advise students who are pre-med. That is my sole job. It's really hard to stay on top of advising if you're doing all of the pre-health fields, plus law, plus people who want to do a PhD, plus people who want to teach, plus people who, you know, want to do everything under the sun, much less across multiple fields and not just in the sciences. And so if people have those kind of advisors, they might feel like they really need somebody who is dedicated to this and knows what they're doing. The other advantage is that certainly our programs, but there are others that do this, do offer a committee letter, which really simplifies the letter submission process for applying to medical schools in a lot of ways.
Most post-bac proofs, especially the academic enhancers, but I think we apply the career changers also. They take the post-bac 1-year program, they complete it, then they apply, and then they have a year before they actually start medical school.
Yes.
And that's typically called the glide year. What do you recommend they do during the glide year?
Well, so one thing that we recommend from the very beginning with students is, you know, so often students are focused on their goal being getting into medical school.
Right.
Which is not entirely accurate. It is a goal, a short-term goal, but it is not the goal.
So it means to an end.
I think, yes, exactly. And so, you know, the goal is really something else external to medical school. It's helping people. It's starting a nonprofit. It's, you know, pushing back the frontiers of science on some disease or critical state, increasing access to a particular population or in a geographic area or whatever it is. And I think that if you keep that goal in mind and you recognize that we are the product of our experiences and the order in which we have our experiences shape the way that we think about the world, then you would recognize that, you know, you have a limited amount of time, my students do anyway, before they go to medical school. And then after you attend medical school, there is like a waterfall sort of exodus from medical school where you're expected to do, you know, residencies and fellowships and whatever else you're doing. And then you're a practicing physician or you're at a hospital or a clinic or whatever. And then all of a sudden, it's kind of a weird time to do other things. And so we tell students to think about any experience that they want to have before all of that stuff that they want to have, a field they want to understand, an experience they want to have, something they want to try out, anything like that that would be frankly weird if you did it in medical school or beyond, your gap year is an excellent time to try that out. So, for example, students who want to understand research better because they're not sure if they want to go whole hog into research in medical school or as a physician or not, it's a good time to do research, certainly. And I have a lot of students that do that. Hopkins is kind of a hub for people interested in research. And so we get a lot of that. But we also have people who are interested in trying to understand how insurance plays a role in how patients access medical care. And so maybe then they would be involved in an insurance company or an outreach group or part of the hospital that deals with all the insurance bits and pieces. Because once they're a practicing physician, frankly, they need to practice medicine. And that's kind of a weird time to say, wait, I'm going to go take a break and work at an insurance company. But it's invaluable in terms of going into medical school and thinking about what does this mean for me? We also have students who want to do international stuff and they want to get a handle on the global landscape of healthcare. All of those things are totally feasible. We have students who are working on language skills, working as translators in clinics because they want to be bilingual or more bilingual or more effective in their language skills in medical school because they want to go to medical school that has hospitals or clinics or populations that would be well served by those skills. So really any of that is fine. We do it in a very individualistic way. You can absolutely use your glide year to fill in gaps if you feel like I'm a little light on community service or research or clinical care, or I would really like to see what it means to do hospice care. Mm-hmm. I really want to understand end-of-life care, or I've never, really been in a surgical setting, so I'm going to do OBGYN work and see how that goes. All of that is totally fine, but usually we have students who have a wish list. They really have always wanted to blank, and your gap year is a good time to try that stuff out before you, frankly, run out of time. I'm sure you and I both have a list of things that we're waiting because now we're at a point in our lives where it's not a good time to say, I'm going to go take a year and do this thing I always wanted to do.
There's also some things that I wanted to do and I probably never will do because I didn't do them when I'm younger.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Also happens.
Yeah, and I encourage my students not to do that. I mean, I always, when I was younger, many, many of my family members have done Peace Corps, and I always wanted to do it, but it just never seemed like the right time, and now I have kids, so now I have to wait until the kids are out of the house, and everybody, I can't, now is not a good time. I can't say, hold right on to that for a minute. And so I have a student right now who's considering doing Peace Corps. That would be 2 years. I have students who want to do Teach for America. They're really interested in that. That's a longer commitment. I have students who really want to focus in research. And so they, maybe spend 2 years doing that. But, it's more about getting to your destination and being grateful for the path there. It's not about how quickly can I get to medical school.
All right. Now, here you talked a little bit about how you wanted to be or considered at least joining the Peace Corps at one point, but I have a different question for you. How did mm-hmm. you, a PhD in molecular biology and biophysics, get so interested in pre-med post-baccalaureate education?
Sure. So my PhD is actually in the biology department.
Sorry.
I was in the – no, it's fine. It's confusing. I was in the biophysics department and I was doing molecular biology work. That's why it's written that way on the website. But
okay.
More directly, what I was really interested in is education and puzzles. Those are really my two great loves.
1,000 piece, 5,000.
Yes. And I, even as a kid, actually, I was pre-vet until I started doing research as an undergrad. And I just loved the puzzle and the curiosity of research. I just was fascinated by the concept that the textbooks that I had in class were full of, the blood, sweat, and tears of, hundreds, thousands of people every day who were working on problems that we literally did not know the answer to. And I was just fascinated by that. And so that combined with the fact that with the PhD, you get to teach on it, in a university setting. I absolutely fell in love with that. And I thought for sure that I would do that. I was a little burned out as an undergrad. And so I took a break for a while and taught before I came back to school for my PhD. And I absolutely loved my time at Hopkins as a graduate student. No question. It was absolutely formative. But I also learned pretty quickly that I didn't want to be in a lab. I saw my, you know, my esteemed faculty as spending a lot of time doing grant writing. And that's what you do before you get a Nobel Prize. Once you get a Nobel Prize, it's way easier to secure money for your lab. But the tenure track path is really scary, and it requires an immense amount of commitment to being in a laboratory setting, you know, from dusk till dawn and beyond. And I looked around me and I saw other people like my husband who are absolutely passionate about the research that they do and being in the lab. My husband would be in the lab constantly if we allowed it. And I didn't love it that much. And I figured that the luxury of having a degree that had lots of options was to figure out what I could be passionate about. And it just, it wasn't pipetting all day and all night. And so I was looking at other things that I really liked, and I started thinking about teaching, and I love the mentorship part of teaching, but I don't love grading students. I don't love assessing students and saying you are good and you are bad, A, you know, C. I don't love that part. I also love writing. I spend a lot of time writing, and I also love innovation and finding new ways of doing things and thinking outside the box and just the fun of creativity. And I honestly just happened upon post-bac. It was not an intentional choice, as wonderful things often aren't.
Right.
But I loved it because it was a mix of working with an older population that I could really engage in deep conversation and really push them to think deeply about their world and what they wanted. There's the educational component. I still would talk science with my students. I teach chemistry boot camp to my career changers. I talk research with a lot of my students. So I'm still, you know, sort of one foot in the sciences. But also, I can spend a lot of time having, frankly, more important conversations about what do you want out of your life? So I'm really grateful that I ended up here. I spend a lot more time helping students think about their world. And I think that's honestly for me better than talking about biophysics and membrane protein association, which is what my thesis was on.
Well, I don't know anything about membrane, whatever it is that you just said. My science background is very limited, and I'm probably exaggerating when I say that. But I certainly know the satisfaction of working one-on-one with young adults and helping them achieve their dreams, figure out what their dreams are sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that is something that's very satisfying about my work, which is, of course, related to what you're doing. So I can hear that really, really well. What would you have liked me to ask you in this interview that I haven't asked?
Well, you had a question on your list about crystal ball, which I thought was sort of an interesting.
Okay, I didn't ask it, and I almost was going to, because you had mentioned all the innovation in the JSI. But okay, what do you see in your crystal ball besides what we talked about earlier?
Sure. Well, I think the thing that I liked about this question is the value that it potentially has for your listeners.
Okay.
Beyond getting to know me or the program, just thinking about themselves and their own world. I think the thing for me about the concept of a crystal ball is that there's something very alluring about the what if and what that could be for you, right? Because usually when you see the image of a crystal ball, somebody is asking, like, what's going to happen in my life? And
they're kind of rubbing it too, right?
Yeah. And I think that's kind of I found it kind of interesting that it was on the list, because it's an interesting metaphor for, I think, the role that advisors play. Certainly, I feel like I played as students. I feel students often come to my office and hope that I have a crystal ball sort of image of what is in store for them and how they can accomplish it. And I think students really want me to reassure them that, you know, they will be fine and the path will be good, and they just have to keep going. And I think the message is that, you know, we have to be able to do that for ourselves. That the more that I think about this concept of crystal ball, for me, I think it's the allure of, like, it could be anything. So when I first read this question, I thought, well, gosh, it could be anything in the world. Anything I can imagine can be accomplished. And all we have to do is think about what is it that we want, and we can make it happen, which is my PhD talking, pulling problems apart, and anything is masterable or solvable. But I think that students don't think of the world in that way. Okay. I think that there is a set of rules and they're supposed to follow them. And there is a keeper of information that will only give them the information if they do the right jig or say the right thing or know the password.
Sometimes there's a checklist approach.
Exactly. And so I think that that is really harmful to students, that, you know, I can help students understand how the choices that they make can impact their future success. But frankly, I'm not really telling them anything they probably don't know. Like, if you don't study for your classes, you're probably not going to do well. Nobody is shocked by that advice.
Right.
But I think that oftentimes students need to feel like there is someone there who will tell them things that they already know. And so, to circle back around, I promise I'm going somewhere.
Okay.
I think that everyone is better off if they just take ownership for their own ability to assess themselves, right? To know that these are things that I need to work on, and these are places in my application that I need. I could do more. I could spend more time on my classes. I really need to do community service. I don't really understand this concept as well as I should. I really feel self-conscious about the amount of clinical time that I have. I haven't really been paying attention to this. I'm spread too thin. These are oftentimes things that students ask me, but they already know the answer to them. And so I think in terms of a crystal ball, the thing that I would love to be able to do for students would be able to empower students with their own crystal balls, to be able to figure it out for themselves. I think that is the holy grail of education, is to not bequeath information to students, but allow them to be able to access it themselves without me needing to be present. I'm not sure if that made sense, but.
And that sounds more like a goal necessarily than a crystal ball kind of, this is what's going to happen.
So yes, well, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not sure what's going to happen.
It's cloudy.
It is. I think it's cloudy for all of us, and that's
right,
the point, right?
Right? For sure.
Anything is possible.
It's interesting concept. I'm glad you insisted that we address this question. I think part of education is conveying information, and I think everybody can sometimes at least benefit from getting input from a second person.
Sure.
But sometimes applicants or students, they don't want to take ownership or responsibility for the life that they're leading. And I don't think it's just limited to students and applicants. It's older people also.
Sure. Yeah.
So
absolutely. And yeah. I do think that that's one of those things that medical schools are looking for, right?
Right.
So
right.
You need to be able to take ownership. And yeah, I mean, it's nice to have somebody to, if, you know, there are obviously in education cases where you simply don't understand and you need somebody to explain quantum mechanics to you or whatever. Obviously, it's good to have someone who says, oh, well, this is how it works. But I think that we spend a lot of time in education helping students with things that we should really be teaching them the tools of how to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in our programs, we spend a lot of time not just working on skills that are helpful for the application process, but just for life in general. Like when you're working on the personal statement, you really should just be working on being a better writer, knowing what you're trying to say and understanding how best to communicate it. It's not just about the personal statement. It's about how do I take this piece of information and ensure that when it ends up on the other end, it is understood as I intended it.
Right.
And do I even know what I'm trying to say? I find a lot of times, sometimes students struggle because they don't know what they're trying to say. And that's a different problem.
That's a completely different problem.
Yeah,
but getting
and so
back,
I think we need to arm them more of that.
Getting back with it, you know, the point that you're making now about somebody taking responsibility for their actions and the life that they're leading, I mean, I think it's a quality that in any field will take you far.
Yes.
You don't like people who play the blame game.
Absolutely.
You know, that's just not a fun game to play if you're on the receiving end of it or you're the second party to it. And I think the qualities, the thought that occurred to me as you were talking about some of the qualities that lead to success in medical school and that medical schools are looking for, yes, fit was a really, really important quality that you mentioned, and that would be unique and different for each particular program. But a lot of those qualities are really, you know, virtues that will help anybody in life, whether it's the lowest level in the hospital, I don't know what that, you know, the guy who kind of mops the floors, or the top administrator in the hospital and all the physicians, nurses, clinicians in between.
I agree.
Resilience, communications, or some of the other self-awareness, maturity, you know, those are qualities that are definitely going to help anybody in life. And I think to the extent that Johns Hopkins nurtures those qualities and helps applicants develop them, they're not only preparing them for medical school, they really are preparing them for life.
Yes, I would hope so. I mean, obviously the program is designed to help students get into medical school, but Hopkins in general is about, you know, preparing the next generation of leaders to be citizens of the world. And so if I have a student who decides halfway through they don't want to go to medical school, I don't view that as a failure. Because I feel like the information we're providing and the education that they're participating in is more than just, you know, going to medical school. It's about thinking about the world. It's about being a problem solver. It's about engaging with other people in a meaningful way. That I agree, I think is incredibly valuable for anyone. And honestly, I would hope that would be something that everyone would come through the door with. But honestly, it's not. We see a lot of people who could stand to see some work on that, which is why we have those non-science components in the HSI curriculum, because maybe that's asking too much that everyone understand how to be a leader and how to move a group, you know, goal forward and how to effectively communicate. Maybe that is asking too much.
Or maybe it's just something that hasn't been taught or learned prior to the school.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. It's asking too much because if we haven't as a country decided that's an important part of what we teach as undergraduate institutions, then it's going to be spotty whether students have that knowledge base or not.
Right. It's true. Dr. Tan, I know you're very, very busy. You have lots to do. I think we're almost out of time. This has been absolutely delightful. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners learn more? Well, actually, you told me ahead of time that the URLs are very long, so I'm not going to ask you where listeners can learn more about post-bac programs, because I'm just going to link to them from the show notes at exhibit.com/264. Again, that's exhibit.com/264. And we're going to link separately to both the Johns Hopkins post-bac programs, as well as to other resources that may be helpful to listeners. Listener, I want to thank you too for joining us for Admission Straight Talk's 264th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with deans, admissions directors, post-bac programs directors, professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. And final reminder from our sponsor, the ADZ of applying to post-bac programs. Download your copy today at accepted.com/PB. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.